by allowing myself to write this book in this way, I have learned things about myself that are invaluable to me. And it was only after I finished the book that I decided to find a neuropsychiatrist and do testing for ADHD.
This is Daring to Tell, the podcast where writers read their true stories of personal daring. Then we talk about writing and life. I am Michelle Rado.
Nothing's gonna make me brave. Nothing's gonna make me brave. Nothing's gonna make me brave except doing what makes me scared.
Sometimes our writing is a whisper that calls to us as a tool to cure what ails us. As is often the case with me, this is sort of a grand sweeping declaration that isn't wholly correct, but it's not entirely wrong either. Writing is a creative impulse. And what fuels our creative impulses? Wrinkles, crevasses, the rifts that make us stumble, or the invisible guardrails we push against. And sometimes the impulses that call to us are so sharp, they pull us from our sleep in the middle of the night. Demand to be heard. ADHD is what I think of as a more, quote, recent diagnosis cropping up in the last couple of decades. I'll say it's not something that had necessarily ever crossed my path or that I'd paid attention to or felt I needed to understand. And it hasn't been until sitting down to think about introducing this very conversation to you that I even decided to go look it up at all. So I did, and according to the Mayo Clinic website, in adults, the main feature of ADHD may include difficulty paying attention, impulsiveness, and restlessness. Oh, Rocky. He's meowing. It's time for his breakfast. Huh, talk about difficulty paying attention. Many adults with ADHD aren't aware they have it. They just know everyday tasks can be a challenge. I will say that in the regular walks I take with writer Nina Lichtenstein, those four letters come out of her mouth on a regular basis. Something I've just absorbed, but not quite as fully as I might have until after this conversation we had about her about-to-be-published memoir in essays called Body, My Life in Parts. What she did was entirely coincidental, quite inventive, and exactly what she needed to do to arrive at this book that is a compelling examination of parts. Parts of a body, of her body, that is, and the many stories she was able to excavate when she set her neurodivergent mind to the effort one short piece at a time. A little background on Nina. She was born and raised in Oslo, Norway. She came to the U.S. as a nanny at the age of 19, expecting to be here for just a year, and here she still is. She has degrees in Jewish studies and French, including a PhD in French literature from the University of Connecticut, an MFA from the University of Southern Maine's Stone Coast program, which we'll hear more about. Of course, she's got a Substack called The Viking Jewess and Other Curiosities. Last but not least, she is the one woman wonder behind Maine Writers Studio, which offers writing classes, a monthly literary salon, and a yearly writing retreat. Best of all, she is my walking partner on most Friday mornings through the wooded conservation land trails on the midcoast of Maine, where we both live. This is why, instead of my usual computer-to-computer recorded conversation, she came over to Flying Pig Farm and sat with me in my husband Phil's music studio for this conversation that shows just what a revelation writing can be when we listen and follow where it wants to take us. Yes, Rocky, breakfast time.
Congratulations. I'm holding in my hand your book, Body, Advanced, My Life in Parts.
An advanced reader's copy.
Yes, an you. Advanced reader's copy, yes. For me.
And I was going to say that sitting here in your husband Phil's studio, surrounded by all these gorgeous instruments, is humbling and inspiring and kind of, I'm kind of giddy. I feel like a kid in the candy shop.
It's really fun.
It's really something.
Do you play any music?
I don't. It's one of my big sort of sadnesses. And it's not too late.
It's not.
You know, I need to. So anyway, this is an inspiration on so many levels. Oh, so thank you for having me back.
It is a pleasure, as always, to talk with you. So we're here because you have your debut memoir out, Body, My Life in Parts. I look at the title as if I need to, because I know this title quite well. Obviously, huge congrats to you on this book coming out. And what is the feeling at this moment? So we're talking in mid-April, mid to late April. Your pub date is May 27th. That's so right. When this episode comes out, it will not be ready yet. People can do their pre-order, but it will be out very shortly. And so what is this moment like for you? Like right before it all comes out, you just got your books in the mail, that exciting unboxing moment and all that. Like it's got to be a little bit of a weird time.
I like that you use the word weird, because that's what it feels like. It feels exhilarating. Also, it's exhausting, because when you are not a big superstar author and you are with an indie press, and I think even with many of the big five subsidiaries today, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
It's all the marketing and publicity falls on the author. And, you know, self-promotion is, you know, as vociferous and vocal and out there and candid and talkative that many people know me and see me, still there's something different to just be pushing out all this, you know, photos and the little preview video thing that I made on YouTube. You know, it's fun, it's creative, it's fast-paced, but I will say that it's also, it's exhausting and humbling. All those things and exciting, you know, planning launch parties and book events and it's a lot. But it's work. It's a full-time job, essentially.
Exactly.
So I don't really know how people do it who, let's say, non-creative full-time jobs.
Right.
And who also publish books.
Right.
Not quite sure how they do it.
I know. It is a lot to do. And it's two completely different types of tasks. And so, yes, there's all that promotional stuff, which I, you know, I'm sure is exhausting. And I've seen you doing all these, you share some little videos with me, and I love being on the inside of all that. But what about like the actual book part?
You mean like the physical part of the book or the content of the book?
The content.
Yes. Yeah, I have to actually say something funny, because I've been doing some interviews and talking with colleagues. And one friend who is pitched and is writing a piece, one of her interview questions was this idea of putting it all on the page, you know, intimate things. And how can I be so candid and like an open book and not, you know, she didn't say and not feel shame, like, or embarrassed whatever. And, you know, it's so interesting. I think what happened to me when I wrote this book, and perhaps it's also who I am. Like, we're speaking now, so you're my audience of one.
Right.
When I write to my audience of one.
Yeah.
And to me, the writing is very intimate. Mm-hmm. And I imagine that one writer who's going to sit down and read these stories as if I'm sharing them in an intimate moment. And of course, it's very different when a book comes out in the world. And I will tell you a funny little story right now, which is that my husband, Tony, is not my reader of one, or an audience of one that I have in mind when I write, because I had a whole entire life before I met him and before we became a couple. And I think many of those things he's quite frankly not interested in hearing about.
Yeah.
But lo and behold, when the books came in the mail the other day and we were sort of flipping through them, and I told you I gave one to my aunt and my cousin, a couple of advanced readers copies, and I noticed that Tony was sitting in the couch and flipping through. And what chapter did he turn to first? Take one wild guess.
Vagina?
You right.
Let me just take a wild guess.
And you know, and then as we went to bed that evening, he goes, well, did you like think about that some of these things are quite intimate and that like I'll be reading it? And I'm like, actually, I didn't, because these are like my stories. And yeah. I understand that that might not be like fun for you, because he's not that he's jealous, but he's, you know, he's not, he's, well, you know, it probably
it's
feels.
It's not even, yeah. And you also don't have to be jealous to say, wait, that's my vagina you're talking about.
So to speak.
Exactly.
You know, so that made me suddenly realize that it's out of my hands now. Mm. And one thing is how your family and friends respond who know you. And another thing is people that you don't know from a hole in the wall.
Exactly.
You know? So it's all, so the reality of that part of the journey is slowly and surely becoming more realistic. Also by the example I gave you when I came today. To you and Phil about the part of the book where I talk about my grandfather's suicide and how my mom found him. She was 25 years old. He was a doctor, and she found him slumped over at his desk in his office. And this idea that when my aunt came to that section of the book, she went to my cousin and said, did you know that Nina's grandfather committed suicide? And suddenly I said, wow, is that... I don't think my mother actually ever said and articulated to me personally how her father died.
Mm.
You know, she told me that he died and that that was sad and it was tragic and she was young and he was so young. He was only 52 years old.
Wow.
That's 7 years younger than I am now.
Yeah.
And so suddenly I'm thinking, even though my mom is in a nursing home and her cognitive abilities are not 100% now, I'm thinking, okay, so she may read this. What will that be like for her specifically? So there's things like that. And I think also, for instance, these things of what we write about from our families and the concept of whose story is it to tell and how do we tell things that have happened in the past, even with people we haven't met.
Right.
Exactly what Alyssa Altman has written about.
I was going to say,
in her lovely book, Permission, that we have experienced her live. And, So, so that's going to be a whole different, I don't want to call it can of worms. I'm going to call it an experience. It's going to be a whole different experience.
It is. And that's the part that I go, I feel like it's true with this podcast. There's like two sides of doing it. There's like, oh, I want to tell people about it. There's the things I want to do. You came to the Woodstock Book Festival, which I was a sponsor at, which is my promotional side. And it's sort of like you put this, I don't know, right brain, left brain, whichever side of the brain it is, you know, the like, I'm going to do this work side of your brain on. And then you start thinking about what the content is of everything. And I go, what am I doing? Like, do I really want everybody to hear this, read this, see this? Yeah.
And the funny thing is that's only becoming apparent to me now.
Mm.
So this idea of permission, I actually never felt held down by the idea of permission.
That's so good.
It is, except now that it's like out there, and I'm starting to feel like, okay, so there will be reactions. I mean, that's life.
Yeah.
It's going to be interesting. And also it's making me kind of very excited about trying to write fiction.
Oh, that's funny. I can't tell you how many people I've spoken with, they put out a memoir, they spend so much time on it, and then their next project, they go, I'm going to try fiction.
And I'm not saying that that fiction won't be massively inspired some life events.
True life, personal events.
But the more I learn about writing and memoir and fiction and how the boundaries blur, the more I'm becoming a fan of what we now call autofiction.
Yeah, yeah.
And we'll see how that goes.
I can totally see that. And it makes me think of another thing, that we can only come to the moment of something at the moment that we come to it. Like, you know, that you say, I didn't even think of that until this moment. And I think that there are times that it's like, I couldn't have planned for this moment in advance. Like, even if I intellectually know, gosh, that's going to be a really interesting thing to put out for the whole world to read. But you don't feel it until something, until the moment when it's about to happen. And then you're like, oh boy.
And I'll tell you something, Michelle. I actually, the more you talk about that now, I think that this is probably something specific to people who create, who live creative lives. And who produce creative output, be it paintings or music or literature or, you know, sculptures, what have you. Because when you feel that drive and that urge to express your truth in that way, nothing can stop you.
Right.
I mean, yes, creative people who are stopped tell stories of becoming ill. So, you know, that's the cost, right?
So the
urge to create based on the inspiration or the story or what you need to create is stronger and completely overshadows any sort of, like, you know, what's it called? We call it the business people. They do risk assessment.
Oh, yeah,
like,
yeah.
There's no risk assessment, you know.
Well, for some people.
Well, but I mean, authors.
Yeah, yeah.
And artists.
Yes.
I mean, yes, we know not to plagiarize. We know not to smear people.
Right.
And to risk lawsuits. You know, there's that stuff. But in terms of, like, putting our soul, our naked soul, and its most intimate preoccupations or phobias or fears or pleasures or, you know, joys in the work.
Yeah.
And now I'm... So thank you for bringing me to this paranoid part of my book journey.
Oh, leave it to me to do that. I'm more than well equipped to worry about those things ahead of time. And to the point of talking about Alyssa Altman's book, which I am, like, deep in the middle of at this particular moment, all those questions, I mean, she really parses them so well. So that is something that perhaps we can look forward to in a future episode. But alas, right now, we are talking about Nina's body.
Yeah, yeah.
All
of it.
All of it. I know. Or at least all the parts.
Yeah.
Right? Is the whole greater than the sum of its parts? I think of these little sayings. But so first, why don't you say, how did this book concept come into being? Because I like this story.
Yeah. So when I entered my MFA program in 2018, I was 53 years old. And contrary to many, you know, MFA students, I didn't actually enter the program with a specific project in mind or a goal. I just wanted really to learn more about writing in the English language, because English is my second language. And so I've always had a little bit of a self-conscious, self-criticizing part of me that I juggle all these languages, and it takes so long for me to get words out sometimes. Mm-hmm. Like, if I don't know a word in English, automatically my brain goes to Norwegian to see if I know the word in Norwegian, and then sometimes I don't, and I think, do I know it in French? And then I even sometimes think, but then maybe I know it in Hebrew. So you can imagine, those are the languages that
it's
and that are the most active parts of my life. And so it takes a really long time, you know. So part of what made me want to pursue that MFA was not for a specific project, but to really be surrounded and inspired and encouraged in a literary environment with mentors and teachers, and to really get a deeper sense of language, right, as a tool to tell stories. And so I'm in my first semester. It's a low residency program, University of Southern Maine. Low residency program is called the Stone Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get together every summer for 9 or 10 days, and every winter. And this was the first residency. And I actually had to hand in my first packet, you know, so creative writing, first 20 pages. to my mentor, and I didn't really have a topic. So mm-hmm. I was scrambling a little bit, thinking, should I use something I have started on and develop it? Maybe, I forget exactly, a week or a few days before the packet was due. And this is classic Nina.
Yeah.
Like today, I called you or texted and said, I'm running 10 minutes late. With my ADHD, I have what a dear friend in Norway has coined for me. She says, you're a time optimist, Nina. Meaning, I always think that I can fit more things into, you know, and deadlines are critical for me in order to really deliver and get things done.
Yeah.
Whether they're imposed by someone else mm-hmm. for a project or I impose them on myself.
Right.
Without deadlines, I would just sit and run around in circles, actually, with like without my head on.
Right.
And so there was a deadline. I woke up one night during the residency and I could barely hobble my way to the bathroom for that predictable by now nighttime pee
mm-hmm.
and my hip was killing me and I had no idea what it was, and I started to obsess, which is another beautiful side of my neurodivergent brain, about what this could be. I write about this in the book, that I had lost a dear friend at that time to ovarian cancer, and so my brain just went down that rabbit hole thinking, she didn't have any pain in her ovaries. She had a pain in her shoulder. She had a pain in her back. You know, she had pain everywhere else. So I'm like, okay, here it is. I have cancer. Like that was what I thought, which doesn't make sense, but it's what I thought.
Yeah.
And before I went back to sleep or tried to go back to sleep, I took that little notepad that mm-hmm. writers often keep next to their bed because, God forbid, we should lose a thought or an idea that we have, you know, in the twilight of sleep and wake.
Yeah, yeah.
And I jotted down just hips, you know, pain, question mark, kind of just to. And then the next day I sat down and I started to write about my hips and just kind of looking at them from different angles in terms of how my hips have served me, how my hips sometimes are uproariously selfish and large and take up space more than I would like. And I started to write into that and just kind of examine what my hips mean to me, how they've, you know, what life has been like so far with these hips. And I started doing some research and I found this beautiful, lovely, sensuous, erotic, powerful poem by Lucille Clifton online called Homage to My Hips. And of course there's a recording of her on YouTube reading it, which is just priceless. And suddenly things start to blossom, you know, and open up. And so that became one chapter in my memoir. When I handed it in to my mentor, her feedback was, give me more of this.
Oh.
And that was the beginning.
That's nice.
And so each packet for the next 2 years, I tackled a different body part.
It's so funny because it's just like, might I say, a very Nina endeavor. It's like, right now, what's happening? And I have my deadline and I have to do it. And here it is. And then it's like, okay, I guess I have something to say. And you did.
Thank you. And I will say this about how we don't always plan, you know, art can't always be planned.
No.
And I think that when I ended up with, you know, a rough first draft by the time I graduated, of course, it went through many iterations and much editing, developmental editing and what have you. But it meant that it feels to me an organic, like it happened organically.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened for a reason.
Yeah.
Like that's the kind of project that was meaningful. And I will say this. This was a time for me that I had not yet been diagnosed with ADHD. And so I have this idea that the grounding in the body, the grounding that it gave me to sit with my body and to consider my body and to write about how my body had taken me through my life and how I had become who I was today, actually gave me what we call in French the fil d'Ariane. It's the Ariadne's thread. It's sort of the through line. It's sort of the thread that connects the pieces.
Right, right.
And it became almost like, not a mystery, but it became like a puzzle pieces fell into place.
Yeah.
And it empowered me at the end to say, you know, I think it's okay if I seek out a professional and get tested.
Mm.
Because I'm writing about all these times in my life.
Interesting, yeah.
When I was probably quite reactive, quite impulsive, quite this and that. And sure, we all have times like that. But when you start to see that red thread and you're like, oh.
Yeah.
And so I would say that that actually was something that I would not have realized as clearly had I not written that book.
Right, right. Well, I love that you trusted, like you trusted your, what your insides were telling you, even through observing all these discrete parts. And there was a thread connecting them all, and it brought you to this, that's really very, it's really something. I mean, it is.
And when you talk about it now, I'm like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
And I will say,
I mean,
also,
it's quite unique.
I will also say that the form, which we see more and more now, of course, which is memoirs in essay.
Right.
That also is something that works well for me and sort of the intention. So I love to write wrong form, but the shorter, I do better with personal essay.
Yeah.
And so the idea of actually putting something together that while there's not one narrative arc and a chronology of beginning and
right,
end,
right.
You can pick the book up and you can read any part of it anytime and put it down. So it's kind of like a great book for people with ADHD.
There we go. There's our plug. Well, with that, then let's get started because I would love to hear. And there's a couple of points you brought up that I hope we'll have time to go into a little bit more. But before we have you read, I was going to just say what all the body parts are that you have in this book as chapters.
Okay.
So we have eyes, which you have been on Daring to Tell before. And eyes was what we heard from before. So if people like this and they haven't heard it, they can always go back and hear more about eyes. Eyes, breasts, nose, skin, teeth, hair, hands, knees, vagina, blood, a bloody mess, back, brain, mouth, and butt together as one thing, perhaps, heart, ears, feet, hips, and belly.
Mm. Is that the order in which they appear in the book?
Yes.
Yeah. That's amazing. That
yeah.
That's nice to hear, actually.
I wanted to look at it in one, because as you say, there's not a narrative arc.
Right.
So it's interesting. So we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
So first, what we're going to hear today is from breasts. And we're not starting at the beginning of breasts. We're going to start with, why don't you describe and then you can jump in and start reading.
Well, this section that you chose, Michelle, has a nice little sort of lead-in, so I can read that as I begin. Breasts as conduit of nourishment, breasts as providers of pleasure, breasts as victims, breasts as witness. I'm 41 years old and I'm standing on the platform of the diving board 10 meters up in the air at the outdoor public pool in Oslo. Not a cloud in the sky, a bright blue expanse above the happy sounds of children and adults as they swim laps, frolic, and slide below. Adrenaline fizzes in my limbs and my heart thumps in my ears as I squirm toward the edge. Lined along the stone border of the round, deep pool, my three middle school-aged sons cheer me on. The lifeguard, a tanned blonde young woman in white shorts and t-shirt with a red cross on its back, gives jumpers the signal by pressing a megaphone to her lips and calling out, "Stand back on the 5 and 7! Go ahead on the 10!" That's me, the 10. I'm about to launch myself freestyle from 10 meters up. I will my toes to the tip of the board, and I try not to notice how far away the 33 feet to the surface below looks from here. This is what my best friend Anne, wild, lovable Anne, also a mother of three, has just convinced me to do. "Jump!" I hear Anne and the boys call out. "Come on, Mama! You can do it!" There's no way out now. The whole park is a movie on pause. I'm out of my body and somewhere else. In a flash, I'm back to my childhood, where life depended on being cool enough to jump. But I'm not a teenager anymore. I'm 41, and this is ridiculous, I hear myself thinking. I don't have to prove anything to anybody. I consider that I can and should turn around and climb back down the gleaming and narrow concrete steps to safety on the ground. Go ahead on 10, the lifeguard repeats loudly, her voice jarring me back to reality. The boys cheer again. Anne whistles loudly. Ending the torture, I leap. After the initial flapping of my arms, I instinctively slap them tight alongside my thighs in order to keep my body vertical for impact. Don't flap your arms straight as a nail, my brain repeats. Splash. Then the muffled sound of water all around me as I sink, sink, sink to the depth of the pool, followed by the exhilarating feeling as I reach the water's surface and gasp, I did it! But the full-bodied frame of a woman who has nursed 3 babies impacts the water differently than that of the lanky teenager I was back in the 1970s. Once out of the pool, my kids flock around me, patting my back and hugging my waist while I try to ignore that my breasts ache as if they had been beaten by a long wooden board. The boys think I am the coolest mama around, and Anne, God bless her playfulness, tries to coax me into doing it one more time. It's always better the second time, she cajoles. I deflect by offering the kids ice cream. The next day, I discover a red and sore lump, warm and hard on the side of my right breast. I feel feverish. And so I find myself at the doctor's office telling the funny story while the 60-something physician feels around for what I guess is an inflammation. And sure enough, he announces a case of acute mastitis and prescribes a course of antibiotics with hot compresses. Today, it's my breasts that urge me onward to remember and witness the behavior of the older, white, privileged male physician toward his younger female patient. Just the doctor and I were in the office, and the door was closed. He was seated at his wooden desk in a Scandinavian and ergonomic office chair, framed photos lining all the surfaces behind him. The doctor running across a finish line at a marathon. The doctor riding a horse on a tropical beach. The doctor on a sailboat, salty and windswept. And the doctor and his family skiing. It's my breasts that take me back to the room, as if it's happening in real time. While I sit bare-chested in a chair at the short end of his desk, he rolls his chair over to perform his exam by palpating my breasts. The thing is, he doesn't pull his hands away once he has identified the inflamed lump. Instead, his hands remain there on me, warm, confident, each one gently cupping a breast while lifting them from below, the way a push-up bra works. I don't recall the way his eyes look, only that he looks straight at me and says, "Well, I must say, you do have particularly well-formed breasts." A flush of heat spreads in my face. Are you kidding me? I'm embarrassed to admit it, but I think I just smiled and say, "Well, thank you," as if his words and actions are a gentlemanly thing. It isn't right all along, but I neither do nor say anything else. I sit humiliated, confused, and bare-breasted, hearing the words I can't believe I'm hearing. I cower, yet remain stoic, the part of my Nordic DNA I've had to work hard to deprogram for my emotional and mental health well-being. I was a married mother of 3, a confident and independent woman with a PhD who, as far as I know, did not come across as submissive or vulnerable. Of course, none of this matters in the dynamics of sexual harassment, just like it mattered not to him whether I was weak or strong. To him, I was fair game, just like all the other women he had most likely made inappropriate comments to and advances toward in his long, illustrious career as a family doctor. Looking back, I feel shame and self-criticism that I did not say, "Excuse me, but do you think this is acceptable? Are you out of your fucking mind? Who do you think you are?" Anything would have been better than what I said and didn't do. I was not an insecure teenager, not like I had been when the male gynecologist caressed my butt after I hopped down from the exam table after my first ever OBGYN visit back in Norway in 1982 when I was 17. I should have spoken up then, and I should have in 2006. At least I wish I had. Shrugging it off as gross male conduct, I have imagined both doctors have since happily retired with zero bad conscience about their boorish behavior. I admit to lately wishing that they have had to face their accusers and deal with the consequences of their unwanted touching. I have wished. If my breast had not been involved with such a splash when they hit the surface, I might not remember so clearly that day when I jumped from the 33-foot diving tower. Despite the delightful sounds of my son's joy and giddiness cheering and whistling me on in cahoots with my best friend Anne, it's my breasts that have played the role of Proust's Madeleine. I remember it all so clearly because of them.
Wow.
It's weird to read it again.
Yeah.
Now, in a way. Even though, how many times have I not read it, like, in edits and stuff?
Right. What is it? How does it feel?
It feels new in a way.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
Because I really feel like it's one thing to write a story. It's another one of those, like, you can't get to that moment until you get there.
Right.
And now here we are, and you're reading it out loud, and you're going... Yeah, and you hear it in a new way, and I'm guessing you feel it in a new way.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah.
It's cool.
I'm so glad.
Yeah, so thank you for letting me read it.
I'm so glad you're here, and thank you for reading it, because I go, oh my God. You know, like, part of my story is that I didn't go to a doctor until I was an adult, and that's a whole other story unto itself. But... I'm so sorry that that happened to you. I mean, good God, to have someone fondle your... I just go, holy shit, what the fuck? So, I'm sorry about that.
And I'll tell you, one of the things that has, you know, writing this and thinking about it and reading it and now reading it again, is this idea of, like, why would I even for a moment consider that a compliment, you know, like,
right,
which is weird.
It is, like, weird, but yeah, you go,
yeah, like,
oh,
what's that
well
about?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Because it's said in such a way as if to suggest that.
Oh,
and
yes.
So you just pick up on those cues.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
But then there's this
ooh.
Ick
yeah.
afterwards.
Yeah.
So let's put that on hold. We were talking also about why I picked the sections
yes.
that I wanted to hear you read. And one huge reason was because when you wrote about this pool scene, it brought back for me a very similar and very different pool scene that I was wondering if you would mind if I would read.
I think that would be lovely.
You, because, you know, I've talked about this on this podcast before. The reason I read, and the reason I read memoir, and the memoirs that I especially like reading, are ones where I go, oh yeah, like something that clicks within me somehow, that I have a very similar experience, but that I'm then able to articulate the difference between what your experience was and my experience. Mm-hmm. And that happened very clearly mm-hmm. with this. So I have my little piece.
That's lovely.
If you don't mind. And I was thinking I'd read it. And then we'll get back into yours if you don't mind. But it's very generous of you to indulge me reading.
And I also am going to be curious to ask you a couple of questions after.
Okay. That's fun.
Yeah.
I would love that.
Obviously.
Yeah.
And
yeah, those, yeah. I mean, I would love to hear what your questions are. Okay, so here's my little piece. This does not have a title. At the age of 6, I dreaded my swimming lesson. My desperation would begin when my mom walked me into the YMCA. The smell of chlorine started the panic fluttering inside of me, which amped up as she'd help me change into my bathing suit, put on the bathing cap, dip into the shower for a few seconds before setting off on the long walk down a bright tiled hallway all the way to the pool. I felt off kilter as my feet squished side to side in wet flip-flops. We'd push open the door to the humid waft of it all, kids splashing, water and sound slapping all around me. What would we have to do today, I'd wonder. I'd slowly descend the ladder to get in. The shallow end came up to the top of my chest, and that was as far as I'd ever want to go. But that was never the plan for swimming lessons. There were two teachers, a younger one, who you could tell was pretty, even with her bathing cap on. The older one had a sharp nose and voice to match. I don't remember any of the other kids who were likely paddling all over the place. When we'd have to go into the deep end, I would cling tightly to the young, pretty swim teacher while the old one chastised me for the marks that I left on her skin. I always wanted my feet on the bottom of the pool. I never wanted my face in the water without holding my nose. I couldn't blow bubbles. I couldn't float. The culmination of the class, putting into practice all these things I couldn't do, was to jump into the deep end from a low diving platform. I hung back to be the last in line. I watched each kid climb up, leap off, disappear into the deep, pop up a few seconds later, then swim for the shallow end. I held my breath with each kid's plop, imagining myself taking the plunge. How could they do it? Why weren't they scared? Didn't water go up their nose, sting their eyes? I knew I'd have to hold my nose and make a straight shot for the side of the pool for something to hold on to while I try and wipe my eyes. I couldn't swim all the way back to the shallow end like they were doing. I was sure I would be laughed at by the kids and criticized by the instructor. At last, it was my turn. That long wait had only built up the dread inside of me. Three steps up was a dizzying height. I could barely stand, looking down into the choppy aqua. I couldn't. I didn't. I backed down in fear and defeat. At least my hot tears were camouflaged by the humidity and condensation on my cheeks, and I walked back the length of the pool that every other kid had swum, back to the shallow end.
Oh, God, I'm with that little girl by the poolside.
Thank you.
That's so special and so vivid.
I'm like gripping my paper.
Yeah. You know, it's so, first of all, I just wanted to say that, like you said, when we read someone else's story and then it evokes things in our own story. That is the beauty of reading stories, and especially of memoir, of course, is this idea of communication and not being alone.
Yeah.
Like feeling, you know, so there's an expansiveness there that connects, right? That connects us.
And yeah.
I think that's probably why there's such a hunger for memoir. Still, even though we're talking about in the business that it's harder and harder to be published or find publishers, but the personal essays are certainly not
right
on the diminishing.
Right,
know.
Right.
I think it's a real desire, a human desire,
yeah,
which is disappearing in so many other aspects of our lives, and mm-hmm. so personal essays offers that place
yeah.
to connect.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
when I listen to you read the story about the diving board and the fear, and you know, I was thinking, if today, if you walk into a pool and the smell of chlorine brings that memory back,
yeah,
because I was thinking, what if Michelle were to write a book about body parts,
right?
Where would that fit in?
I was thinking that same thing after I, like, when you're story reminded me about when I didn't jump.
Right.
And I went back and I looked at it. And then I thought, what body part would this be? Hmm. I think I would put it with nose.
That's what I thought too.
Yeah. Because it definitely, the smell of chlorine still, I go, oh. Like it just brings on a little bit of anxiety for me. Even though, I am not a good swimmer to this day. Yeah, so nose. The other reason, I didn't go into it too much, and if I was to rewrite it with this sort of lens, I think what I would say is that feeling when the water goes up your nose and how it's all in your sinus and that That's burn, awful. And I hate that, and that would be my, like, I would always end up having that, like, I didn't know how to breathe out, and I don't know, couldn't do it right.
I can feel that sensation now by you just talking about it and describing it.
Yeah.
I mean, that, it's so, but, like, what made me able to just snort it back out and move on?
Yeah.
And yet, for you, it was just a non,
it was
just
like, was not, stop, not everything must stop. Yeah. Exactly. Something? I know.
It's amazing.
And that is where I go. We're all just very different creatures. And isn't that wonderful? And isn't that why, I mean, I know a part of the reason why this book is and what you have in the back is to encourage other people to write. And so I can see that very clearly. With all of these examples that it's like, oh, what would I think about this body part? Or I guess one of my other questions in putting this together is, we've talked about this book, but you haven't talked a lot about it. So I knew each body part was a chapter, but within each chapter, you have often several discrete stories that have nothing to do with each other other than the body part as sort of the anchor for that. How did you decide what stories were going to go into each chapter, each body part chapter?
That's such a good question, Michelle, because I didn't decide. I mean, really.
The writing well, in the decide?
Editing,
or,
right, in the editing, things were edited out. Or things, you know.
Were there stories, whole stories you ejected out?
No, actually, there were parts of stories.
Okay.
More typically, like, because what happens, and I write about this and talk about this a lot, is that in this process, because people are curious about the process,
yes,
you know,
exactly,
of body writing or body-based writing or being sort of an embodied writer, what happens, or what I find happens in this process, is that you open the door and you start down one path and then the path forks. And so as a writer, we want to finish that story.
Yeah.
And then you know that there's been all these veerings off.
Yeah.
And I would pursue them to say, what's down here? And why does this suddenly now comes up? As you may recall, other parts of, for instance, my nose chapter had to do exactly with what the smell of chicken shit fertilizer evokes in me, like so viscerally, the same that the chlorine does for you. First and foremost, it was the stable that I used to spend so much time in growing up in Oslo, where I was a horseback rider and a competitor and what have you, and a groomer. But then immediately I went on to spending summers, or being sent away to spend summers at a farm, which was very common in the 70s of city parents who were both working.
Right.
You know, what to do, that long, long, long vacation.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
You had your family vacation. There was still 3 weeks
more
left,
time,
you know?
Yeah.
And so I started to go there because that was also something I hadn't thought about for decades. Mm. And I realized that my body and the memory of the smell of a barnyard and animals and the pig pen and the horse's mane and the hay and sitting on the back of the combine with the farmer, you know, those things, it was part of another story that actually it felt like a joy and sort of a gift to be able to go there again.
Yeah.
Even the hard parts, even writing about the moment in the doctor's office, you could say, and I warn people, you know, when you go into the body parts, because your body does keep the score,
yes,
you know, as Bessel van der Kolk says, that you may discover and come upon things that you, that won't be easy, right, and you may not want to go there, or you can go there and realize that articulating experience and emotions around that moment has its own redemptive value. Mm-hmm. Part of healing. I mean, this is part of narrative medicine.
Right.
Yeah. So the process. So then I would end up having a few.
Yeah.
You know, you call it discrete stories.
Yeah.
For each body part. And sometimes I would go on and on within a discrete story, and a reader or editor would go, well, you're losing me here. Like, what does this have to do? Like, we're too far away. Bring us back.
Right.
And so either it meant cutting.
Right.
Or it meant, okay, like, reconnect us.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Find, go back to the anchor
of
that body part.
Yeah.
Because as a reader, we need that.
Exactly.
And so that was very useful and a good exercise.
And how did you decide which body parts you were going to focus on?
Yeah, that I didn't decide that either. I mean, I didn't sit down and say, here, let's make a list of all. Because you may notice that some of the body parts are like the heart. You know, people would call that an organ, a vital organ.
Right.
Not a digit or, you know, like.
Well.
So there's, or skin, you know.
Right.
I mean, we know,
yes,
like intellectually, that they're body parts. But on the other hand, when we're young and we learn about body parts, it's often like feet, you know, shoulder, head,
shoulders, knees and toes.
It's that, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I have to say that I'm sure at some point I thought about starting on the top and sort of working my way down.
I mean, that would have been logical.
Right.
You know,
because there's hair.
I like that it's not that.
There's hair, there's eyes, there's nose, there's mouth.
Exactly.
There's even teeth.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And ears. So we're very like top heavy.
Yes, we are. Yeah.
Despite the girth of the hips, we're top heavy. and I think that, so this is probably something that you wanted to talk about, which comes naturally now, is this idea of ordering of the chapters.
Yeah.
Because they're not ordered with starting with brain
or head and
hair and down to toes.
Right.
So after I had written everything and started to say, well, how should we order them? I really had to take a look at, for instance, not revealing something early on that would come later.
Exactly.
And also not telling the story of something that happened when, say, I was 38 before something that happened when I was a child. So there was a little bit of a shuffling there.
Yeah.
And it required printing it out.
I was going to say.
Because like like visually or on the screen, I couldn't even handle
it. No, you can't.
So printing it out and having the chapters sort of physically and sort of imagining. Yeah. And there was some back and forth there when after, you know, I finally landed on this order.
So, but you probably had to at that point, because I was thinking the same thing. Like, there are things that get referred to earlier in the book that do come back again later in the book. And it's not inappropriate that it's there later. We have familiarity with it. But I would assume that once you did have all the chapters in order, you would have to go through again and go like, as you heard in it, because you do in that several places, you're like, as you remember from the chapter on hips or whatever it was. Yeah.
I think I even say, see chapter.
See
teeth, you know,
see vagina, I think was one of them, which I was like, good for you. But to go back to the heart, I would say it would be hard pressed for you to write a story about the body and not include heart. Because it is, yes, it's an organ, but it's also the center of us.
And how lucky am I that I can write about my heart and not include heart medical issues?
Yeah.
Because, of course, for some other people, that would be
a
big story.
A very big story.
And so I was able to go almost right away into metaphor.
Yes.
Of heartbreak.
Yeah.
You know, and the feeling.
Yeah.
The feelings in our hearts,
you know.
And so that, of course, opened up a whole nother, not Pandora's box, but treasure chest, as I like to call it.
Yeah, exactly.
Of things that aren't easy to think about or talk about. But I'm grateful that I had the opportunity.
Yeah, and they're all there. You know, I mean, I think to recognize them all is also a beautiful thing. And we are many parts, some of them hard and some of them beautiful and some of them maybe not the most flattering.
Perhaps.
There's that.
But they're all there and they're part of us and you go there.
I have to tell you that my husband would never, ever in a million years. I mean, he's a philosopher, you know,
yeah.
He writes on philology and Bible and all sorts of things. He's so private.
Yeah.
And I'm so not private. I mean, to a fault. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
So it's going tough. To be an interesting journey. We will journey.
See. Exactly.
Because, you know, at this stage, people who read the book, it's people who are interested in reviewing, people who usually want the best for the author. But, you know, once it's out in the world, it'll be interesting to see the
It's
pushback.
Not yours anymore.
It's not mine.
I know. That's really
something.
And I'm going
to have to just have the thick skin, you know, and walk away and say, hey, you know, that's it is what it is.
It is what it is. So, next. Here's another fun one. Hands.
Yes. I will tell you that I had written my hand chapter and submitted it.
Uh-huh.
And this part that you had suggested I read was not in the original draft.
Oh.
Because my mentor pushed me further.
Oh.
And she said, when I love this prompt and I use it when I teach, she said, have you protected or defended yourself with your hands?
That was a good question.
And that was never anything that I would, you know, I didn't think about like violence, you know. I thought about the accident of the scar on my finger. I thought about the way my three sons held me also differently in their holding of my hand or gripping or not when they were little.
Yeah.
And how that has become sort of a metaphor for me about their personalities growing into adult life.
Mm-hmm.
How they're so different. No.
Yeah.
And so those were there. But this part was not there. And boy, was it fun to write this part.
I will say it has a lot of energy, and part of the reason why I wanted to have you read this one is for this unknown quote at the very beginning. I just burst out laughing when I read
great.
That. So with that, let's hear from...
Would you read that quote?
Oh.
I would love that.
I will. Look, I got a little chill
Give
when you
asked.
Give
me the pleasure of having that moment.
So, hands... You can tell a lot about a woman by her hands. For instance, if they're placed around your throat, she's probably slightly upset.
And with that, through the red and blue strobing lights and low seeping cloud of cigarette smoke, I take in the fat 40-something standing by the bar, laughing with a bunch of men all around his age, smug, entitled, boozed up. I run toward him from the side, my arm raised and my hand clenched. When I get within reach, I pull my fist back for maximum velocity and punch his jaw. Down he goes. It's a knockout of epic proportions. I'm 25 and really, really pissed off. A writing mentor once asked if I have ever used my hands to defend myself. And the answer is hell yeah. It happened in Oslo on a pleasantly warm summer evening in the early 1990s when my best friend Anne and my sister Tuna and I were out on the town. We wanted to dance and have a few more drinks and headed to the iconic nightclub Frascati, known to draw a more mature clientele. It was also the place to pick up high-end prostitutes, a fact I only learned later. Frascati was on the second floor of an elegant commercial building downtown, and to access it, we had to go through the large glass front doors and then follow a grand marble staircase to the dramatic entry of the club. Up we went in good spirits, all a little tipsy, the groovy rhythms of Motown hits bellowing through the building. I was dressed in long cream-colored palazzo pants and a matching blazer with sheer floral sleeves. I also wore pearl earrings. In all, it was an outfit that was uncharacteristically preppy and elegant relative to my usual bohemian style. A bouncer with bulging muscles asked for our IDs, while a 40-something man with a paunch and business suit was greeted with smiles and sailed right through. A regular guest, I thought, miffed at the differential treatment. But suddenly, and before he disappeared through the curtains separating the club from the foyer, the man turned to me, a whiff of alcohol preceding him. His eyes didn't quite focus as he leaned in, too close. "You look like a cheap hooker, you know that?" he said. Then he swung around and pranced through the heavy doorway draperies. I was so stunned, I didn't even have a chance to respond, but a pang of adrenaline rushed through my body. The bouncer let us in, oblivious to the offense that had just taken place right in front of him. Barely inside, I spotted the asshole immediately through the smoke, my eyes' narrow slits focusing in on his silhouette. I became an instant homing device on the tip of a charged torpedo. That's when I punched the motherfucker. Before I had a chance to notice how the people standing around him reacted, I turned on my heels and ran out through the velvet drapes, anticipating an aggressive reaction. I flew down the majestic stairs, but the soles of my shoes slipped on the marble and I landed on my butt, sliding down the rest of the hard stairs on my back. Bam, 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 down I went. My sister and Anne followed behind, confused and squealing as we all ran outside. We tumbled together in a cluster on the sidewalk, breathless and cracking up, while they asked me if I was okay and what the heck just happened. The knuckles on my right hand ached and pulsated, and my heart pumped out of my chest. I hadn't hit anyone since I straddled Svante Hustad in eighth grade and gave him a bloody nose for bullying a new kid in our class. Just as we were catching our breath, the muscly bouncer barged through the front door, scowling, puffed up like a blowfish, heading straight toward us, fast. I reached into my purse for the bottle of mace that I had never used, but that I knew was in there somewhere. My American sister-in-law had gifted it to me, concerned about me traveling alone without their brother, my husband. At the time, I had snickered internally at what I saw as their paranoia. I pulled out the little handy-dandy spray bottle and aimed it in the bouncer's direction, fumbling to find the trigger. He was already so close that he managed to grab my wrist and bend my arm back, which made the fine mist of blinding agent change direction straight into my face. I screamed in pain. Tuna and Anna responded by jumping on his back, kicking and screaming. Before we knew it, a police van pulled up on the sidewalk next to us and two cops broke up the fight. The three of us girls were escorted into the back of the black, ominous van while the officers kept the beefy bouncer outside, questioning him. That's when I noticed that my punching hand was bleeding and my back was in agony from the bumpy ride down the stairs. I also felt nauseous and had trouble breathing from the spray and my eyes stung like hell. I was a mess. And the police decided to take us to the ER to have me checked out. No charges were pressed, and if anything, the cops and the ER staff seemed humored by my moxie without saying it out loud. In later years, Anne, my sister, and I have giggled at the doctor's notes, which we sneaked a peek at when he stepped out of the room. "Patient smells like ethanol," it said. Indeed, she did. Much later, around 4 a.m., birds chirping and Oslo's midsummer night sky already blue and bright, my sister and I crawled out of a taxi outside our parents' apartment building. We were exhausted but exhilarating and had a damn good story to tell our folks. The next morning, with a white gauze bandage around my fist and open surface wounds along my spine, I hobbled into our sunny top-floor kitchen. There, smoking his usual cigarettes and sipping his coffee, our dad made us breakfast while we recounted the dramatic events of the night before. He smiled and laughed and told us he was proud of his girls for standing up to a man's insult. He later loved to tell guy friends about the Frascati incident of his daughters not taking shit from a guy, and in time the story took on mythic proportions. My three now adult sons still love to hear it repeated today, how their mama punched a slime bag. With my hands, I sew buttons and hem curtains and make delicious meals and shovel snow. I paint walls and furniture, plant flowers and vegetables in our garden, and carry heavy groceries from the store. My hands do laundry and iron and clean windows and floors and massage my beloved's feet and scratch his back. My hands and fingers collaborate with my mind and heart to write the stories I must tell. I hold the door for the person behind me, and I hand over a homemade meal to a neighbor. But best of all is when my hands reach out to embrace those I love, and even, on occasion, a stranger.
Oh my God.
That's that story. I'm like, that's action sweating.
That was, I mean, it's riveting. The energy in it is so powerful. And I go, whoa, my Nina, look at her. I mean, whoa. I just, I also love what's so great about this book is that next to the story about punching out this asshole is my hands sew things and hem curtains and hug people. I mean, it's such an interesting way to see what we as parts and as a human contain so much in us.
It's really, which again is to me a testament to how the body is such a wealth of a container for our stories.
Yeah.
You know, each of those things that I say afterwards, that I do this and this and that, are beautiful prompts when we do writing together. You know, what all these hands, and the feet too. Mm-hmm. Like, not just, you know, I had a pedicure or I had foot surgery or, you know, my ankle broke, but really, like, where have your feet taken you?
Yeah.
What have you run away from?
Yeah.
What have you run toward?
Exactly.
What do you have to tiptoe around in your life? Mm. You know, there's so many beautiful metaphors and sort of extensions of thinking about the body part that are really generative.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I've taken a class with you because you teach this too in workshops, which is wonderful for anyone who wants to do more writing and be generative about it. And I remember you asked that question about hands, like, how have your hands defended you, or have they? And I was like, no, like, I couldn't think of anything. I mean, it was one of those things where I went, I don't think I ever have, you know. So these are, again, there's the ways that our stories may be inverse, or that maybe I need to think about this a little more, because it could spark something that maybe I haven't thought about in a long time. And it's sort of like, well, be ready for what might come back.
Well, Michelle, whenever you're about to be stung by a mosquito, do you just let it do it, or do you swat?
Oh, yes. Yeah, okay, know. So I guess, like, that's an example.
I mean, I know that we prefer to take, you know, ladybugs and spiders outside and go free, you know.
Ladybugs, not spiders. I'm getting better.
So, you know, there's so many ways to think about that, you know, protect.
Yes, protect exactly.
Yourself or defend yourself.
I know.
And also, you know, think about how many people in this world live with violent situations.
Yes.
Or
I know.
War.
I know.
And where the notion of defending yourself takes on a whole different. So I will say, if I may, one thing about writing memoir. When you come into an MFA program, you realize that many people come with very specific stories that they have to tell because they can't carry the burden of holding it inside anymore.
Right.
And it's very often a trauma that they have experienced.
Right.
And I felt, this is coming sort of full circle back to how did this project start.
Mm-hmm.
It almost felt a little bit like I didn't feel like I had a legitimate reason to write. I mean, this is weird to say, but as if, you know, well, you know, I had this childhood in Norway, which is one of the world's most affluent and privileged countries with socialized medicine. My parents were married until I was in my 30s, you know. I hadn't experienced major traumatic things either as a child or as a young adult. And I didn't come from that place. And it was kind of a reckoning for me, actually, personally, too. Of course, in the process of writing the book, you realize that there are so many kinds of trauma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that I have my own share. I have experienced them. While they may not be big natural disasters or war or abuse in a catastrophic way. There are moments in my life, as in everyone's life,
yes.
because that's what it means to be alive. We grieve, we have losses, you know,
right.
Breakups. We lose people that are very close to us. We lose mm-hmm. our beloved pets. I mean, there are things that, you know, provoke and evoke and put us in places that really are life altering.
Yeah.
And so it was a chance for me to come, you know, this is a kind of an extreme example. And so I'm not going to use it as a parallel to me, but the mother of a dear friend of mine is Jewish and grew up in Norway during World War II. And she was a little girl who, at four years old, I think around that, in 1942, when Norway was occupied by Germany and Jews either were hiding mm-hmm. or they escaped to Sweden or
yeah.
they were rounded up and sent to Auschwitz.
Right.
Well, this woman who was 4 years old was put into a backpack with crossing guards, and with her family, they fled through the forest into Sweden, where she lived a nice childhood until they could return to Norway after the war.
Wow.
She never considered herself a Holocaust survivor.
Right.
Because she didn't experience the camps.
Right, right.
Or abuse at the hands of, until she realized late in life that in fact her experience of having been carried and snuck out, and you know, and what this, and also of course the whole cloud that this kind of experience envelops in the family, where most of the people didn't make it out.
Right, right.
But so that was a coming to terms with, and a realization really for her, and she ended up writing several books about this later in life.
Wow.
And so there's that part that we come to understand our stories. If we're lucky, I guess.
Yeah,
and we have
exactly.
the opportunity.
Exactly. I think that's exactly right. One of the things that I was wondering about, somewhere in the book, I believe you allude to the emotional impact of the body parts on us. Like there's the emotional impact of what is there. And what and about listening to what it has to say. And what would you say is the emotional impact of this book now that it's in print, mm-hmm. you know, has there been a different perspective that you have after writing all this? I mean, it feels like this might be a little bit of it, but.
That's a good question. Like you're asking me about the emotional impact after
yeah. of having mined all these stories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that for me, the emotional impact has been the value I have come to appreciate of examining our own life in this way, in writing specifically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Because that's the art form that I'm mostly engaged in. And the idea that, you know, who was it that said, was it Socrates, that to live an unexamined life is not, you know, it's not a life worth living.
Yeah, something.
You know, this idea that to, quote unquote, justify a book about oneself that doesn't necessarily tell a sweeping story of an addiction recovery, or, you know, like a big story that, say, someone who's had that exact experience can find comfort in and
right.
find helpful.
Right.
Because that's not the kind of book that I've written. So we all talk about memoirists and navel gazing and the whole idea of that, right? And so I will say that by allowing myself to write this book in this way, I have learned things about myself that are invaluable to me. For example, I talked about the red thread earlier. And it was only after I finished the book, and actually it had been accepted for publication, that I decided to find a neuropsychiatrist and do a testing for ADHD.
Yeah.
Because as I wrote about all these different parts of my life, I realized that I had been a lot more reactive and the punching of the guy is an example of that. Most women would not have done that.
Right.
What's that all about? You know, I don't walk around town and like punch people. But that was like a total.
Yeah.
I was like completely hijacked by rage. Today, I would have today I would have taken a deep breath, might have had an extra drink, but I would have thought the poor bastard, you know, he's clearly really drunk. And I would have dealt with it differently. Also because one, I'm older, I have studied and learned and, you know, meditation and yoga and mindfulness and you have it. But I wouldn't have really seen the things as clearly for myself had I not written this book. And when I received the clinician, he just looked at me after, and this was a long, long test. It took not just the time in the office, which was a whole day with a lunch break, but also papers to fill out at home and also papers to actually ask loved ones to evaluate. And when I came back, you know, I was curious what he had to say. I was actually nervous that he was going to say, well, you're borderline, or like, this is, you know, is within normal boundaries. You know, you're a busy woman with, you know, three kids and blah, blah, blah. No. He was like emphatic. He's like, you're a classic case.
Wow.
And to hear that from a medical professional who had no skin in the game, he wasn't going to, you know, earn anything from giving me meds, for example, was... And I talk about this in a recent interview on Creatively ADHD, which is a Substack.
Oh.
That it was a huge relief. It was almost redemptive.
Yeah.
To hear those words, because it made me feel like I didn't do these things because I'm a bad person or because I made poor choices
all along.
A lot of these things that happened to me and for which I had consequences as a child, as a teenager, and in my former marriage, I would say, my reactivity, you know, and sort of emotional dysregulation, which are sort of catchphrases within the ADHD diagnosis, are part of it. And I wouldn't have learned these things as acutely and as, not gently, but as much in like cahoots with myself. You know, like I came to this.
Yeah.
Through the work of this book, I think.
Right.
Rather than me saying just, or someone saying to me, you better get checked out, you know, like you are like way too reactive.
Yes. It was your, the word that came to me as you were trying to figure it out is holistically.
Yeah.
Like through examining the parts, you did come up with this holistic view of yourself that is, it sounds to me, and I feel that you understand much more clearly than you would have had you not written the book, and it would have been like, oh, well, that's so interesting.
So from that point of view, that is, because your original question was, what does it feel like now, and what are you thinking, you know? So that's something that, if for nothing else, if the book is trashed by whatever critics, you know, or it doesn't really sell or do well, you know, I know that I have done something for me, which is valuable.
And valuable for other people. Valuable for other writers as a tool. I mean, it's a wonderful way of getting into more writing. And valuable for any reader who, let's see, has a body.
Yeah. One of my blurbers, God bless her, you know, her last sentence in her blurb was, anyone with a body should read this book.
Yes.
And I'm like, ta-da, there you go.
Exactly. There's your target audience, people with bodies.
Yeah. I will just say that, Michelle, I have realized something else as the book has been in sort of production mode, is that inadvertently, and perhaps also organically, which is a nice way to think about it, I think that I've actually created a kind of a craft book by example. And so, as you know, you mentioned these earlier, that in the back of the book there's an appendix with writing or thinking prompts for people to enter their own sort of stories.
Right.
That's sort of one thing. And then the book itself is a demonstration, if you will, of that in action. And I think this has become clearer to me as I've been teaching
this
topic.
Right.
So, yeah.
One word that you said that I did want to come back to
and that I thought was exemplified well by these two readings back to back, is reactivity. And I think that we see throughout many of these body parts different degrees of reactivity. It's like maybe it's a little like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. Like, here's a situation where you didn't quite react as much as you should have, and here's another one where you maybe overreacted a little bit. But eventually, I don't know, it doesn't have to be a happy ending. And I always come back to that because I guess that's my nature as an optimist. Mm. But, you know, that there is, like, how do we find ourselves to come to a middle point or an acceptance point of something?
That's the word I was going to say. You took it from me, or you arrived at it with me. That's how I feel that the book shows is the acceptance of this person and the points that sometimes, like you say, felt that you didn't have control, and other times perhaps you tried too hard or you didn't try hard enough.
Kept it all in.
Yeah. And I think that's the note that I end the book on too, has something to do with that.
Yeah.
Sort of, not resignation, but sort of acceptance.
Right, exactly.
And, I don't know. I would never have written this same book had I been 25 or 35 or even 45. I mean, really.
Yeah.
There's an element of, I mean, this is a mature woman who's written that book. And with age.
Yeah.
We do, luckily, gain some wisdom. And
oh, yeah. I mean, to come back to another theme that I think we started off with, too, is you couldn't have come to it until the moment that you're ready to come to it. And you came to this book when you were ready to come to it. You cannot get out without answering. What was most daring about writing this book? What was most daring?
Oh, you should have sent me that question in advance to think about it a little. What was most daring to write about in this book? That's so interesting. I would have to say the parts that involve my divorce, and specifically the experience of, well, there's daring and then there's painful,
Right.
And those probably go hand in hand.
I was going to say,
you know, 'cause it has
those
to
are the things we angst over the most.
And that probably has to do with, it's daring to tell, not just because there are intimate moments and scenes, but also because there's a coming to terms with the loss and the grief that at the time, actually, I didn't really quite face.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't grieve in a way that I think was healthy at the time. And writing about it has given me permission and allowed me that, because time has gone and I'm, you know, no longer that person, right?
We
change and we learn and we grow. And so that probably, I would say, was daring. Not so much vis-a-vis the world, as vis-a-vis myself.
Right.
Some people might read it and go, okay, a little too much information, but, you know, so that's going to be interesting.
I think it's a very, very brave book. I mean, I think on so many levels, I appreciate what you've shared with us. As someone who knows you and goes for walks with you, you know, I feel like, I literally felt like, oh, did you know this about Nina? And I thought, well, I shouldn't say anything about it. And I thought, wait, it's coming out in her book. She's telling everybody. And I say that 100% to the credit of the writing, that it's so intimate. And like we were saying again at the beginning of, this is a one-on-one communication. You sit down and you're sharing it to an audience of one. And I sit down as a reader reading it as an audience of one. And
you felt that?
Yeah.
That to me is
so much intimacy.
Really lovely. Because I will say that compared to so much candid and frank and kind of fresh, and the word isn't rude, the word is no boundaries. right? Mm-hmm. No holding back stories that are out there or ways of writing.
Right.
I actually don't think that I go there, right?
Right.
Because also it's not my style.
Right, right.
So I know that I have a propensity to make things lighter with humor or sort of a sassiness in the voice, you know, which is why it meant so much for me to get the blurb from our beloved Abby Thomas or Abigail Thomas, because I consider her a real like badass memoir writer.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's like depth and it's not just for the sake of,
right,
you know?
Yeah.
And I hope that finds resonance with people, with readers.
Yeah, I think it will. Nina Lichtenstein, thank you so much for being here with me on Daring to Tell again.
And thank you for having me here. It's so much fun. And I just love this space and being here on Flying Pig Farm.
Flying Pig Farm, that's right.
Thank you.
Oh, the daring. This is always my question, I have to say. I might have been saying, yeah, when Nina was talking all about being in her head of writing just to an audience of one while she was doing the work. I have a whole crowd of naysayers sitting on my shoulder whenever I set fingers to keyboard, so that's something I need to work on. I even neglected to ask her who the audience of one was. Is it someone she knows, an imaginary reader, or maybe her MFA mentor? I don't know. Anyway, it's just one of those questions I will have to put to her on our next walk. And maybe I can even remember to keep you posted on her answer in my next newsletter that I put out once a month called The Redo, where I address these very sorts of questions I neglect to ask or only think about after the conversation. Anyway, Nina was also mentioning Alyssa Altman, whose brand new book called Permission is a memoirist's dream, not to mention an amazing read overall, and the book Nina and I just can't stop talking about. Well, Alyssa Altman has agreed to be a guest on this podcast. I am so excited to talk with her about her book. And so you might want to hit follow on this podcast so you will not miss that episode when it comes out on the first Tuesday in June. I am working in all my relevant contact details here, but the most pertinent ones for this episode are finding Nina Lichtenstein and her new book, Body, My Life in Parts. It will be out on May 27th, so you can pre-order that now. A link in the show notes will take you to her website, Maine Writers Studio, where you can check out her class offerings as well, which she does hybrid of being on both Zoom and or in person. You can pick whichever option is best for you. There is also a retreat she is going to be offering this fall in a gorgeous off the coast of Maine location. I think it's in October, which is a beautiful, beautiful time to be here, although there's hardly a non-beautiful time to be here. It might be mud season is kind of the least attractive time. Anyways, the retreat will be focused all around generative writing based on the body. So I will have a link for that, as well as a link for her Substack. You can subscribe to The Viking Jewess and Other Curiosities. My many thanks to Nina for your words and for your friendship. I also want to thank, as I always do, my husband, Phil Rado, for his music that I co-opt on a regular basis for this podcast, and also for his technical assistance and use of his studio space for this episode. Most of all, my sincere thanks to you for making it to the very end of this episode and for daring to listen. I will catch you next time.
And nothing's gonna break my fall. There's nothing in the protocol. It's like swimming up waterfall or taking away the ground. Taking away the ground. It's like taking away the ground.